Welcome to the meditation group. It's nice to see you all. It's been a while. I've been here. It actually was my turn just before I was going to Newbury. I'm helping at the monastery over in Melbourne, but I do visas for the monastery and a bit of secretary work. And that work usually just whenever it arises, I just have to do it. So when I see there is less work, I grab the opportunity and go on retreat. So that way I could get out of coming to Armidale. But I just came back on Friday.
Very honest.
Yes, and Ajahn Brahm has a bit of a cold. He might have, when you watch him on YouTube. So he asked if my energy levels were okay, and I said yes, sure. But the day today was actually quite busy, so I was happy to have a little rest in the car, and I'm happy to have a meditation with you tonight. And before I came in here, I went to the rest room, and I was surprised. Even in the rest room, I mean, I know it's a doctor's office, but I sat there, and there's this huge poster posted there, so when you're sitting on the toilet, it's right in your face, and it says, what was it, take the first step against toxic fat or something. So anyway, I think I'm fine. But I was thinking, you know, in the monastery we don't do that, but if we would, we would put up very, very different signs. We would say, let go and be happy. Okay, usually I do bring something little to get the conversation going, and it's also something that has to do with meditation, because we'll be meditating together afterwards, and it's nice that you get different monastics and different stories to kind of get a different approach to meditation, hopefully every time. Do we have some people who have never meditated here? Some newbies? No? Okay, everyone. Wonderful. Very good. But we should have a beginner's mind anyway, so we are beginning every time. Oh, yes, we should have done the Metta Sutta, isn't it? Let's do that first. Wonderful. I have a bit of a high voice, so we'll see how we go. Get my deep voice out.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings they may be. Whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Right, so I'm from Switzerland, and when I was quite young, I don't know actually when, I read a book by Michael Ende, a German writer, Michael Ende means actually end, and some of you might know him from the movie or from his book, The Neverending Story. Yeah, okay. He has written many other very nice books, and one of them is called Momo. In English, they call it The Grey Gentleman. And it's a very nice story of a little girl, and she's kind of the main character in that story. And there is those grey gentlemen that turn up and that steal the time of the people. And she is the only one who resists them and in the end saves everyone who has kind of given their time away and is just rushing all over the place. And there is a couple of sections in that book that I reread recently that for myself really kind of talk about meditation. Maybe it's just me, maybe I just have my mind set on meditation and I look at it from that perspective. But when I was reading it again, it just kind of struck me how close it is to what meditation is. So I wanted to read that out. And the chapter it's from is... Oops, what was it? It's called Listening, I think. And I just called it Listening like Momo. Right. Momo received a stream of visitors. She was almost always to be seen with someone sitting beside her, talking earnestly, and those who needed her but couldn't come themselves would send for her instead. As for those who needed her but hadn't yet realized it, the others used to tell them, why not go and see Momo? In time, these words became a stock phrase with the local inhabitants, just as they said, all the best, or so long, or heaven only knows, so they took to saying, on all sorts of occasions, why not go and see Momo? Was Momo so incredibly bright that she always gave good advice, or found the right words to console people in need of consolation, or delivered fair and far-sighted opinions on their problems? No, she was no more capable of that than anyone else of her age. They say she must have been about 9, 10, 11, 12, something like that, a young girl. So could she do things that put people in a good mood? Could she sing like a bird or play an instrument? Given that she lived in a kind of circus, she lived in an amphitheater, could she dance or do acrobatics? No, it wasn't any of these either. Was she a witch then? Did she know some magic spells that would drive away troubles and cares? Could she read a person's palm or foretell the future in some other way? No, what Momo was better at than anyone else was listening. Anyone can listen. You may say, what's so special about that? But you'd be wrong. Very few people know how to listen properly. And Momo's way of listening was quite unique. She listened in a way that made slow-witted people have flashes of inspiration. It wasn't that she actually said anything or asked questions that put such ideas into their heads. She simply sat there and listened with the utmost attention and empathy. I'll read that again. She simply sat there and listened with the utmost attention and empathy, gazing at them with her big, dark eyes, and they suddenly became aware of ideas whose existence they had never suspected. Momo could listen in such a way that worried and undecided people knew their own minds from one moment to the next. Or shy people felt suddenly confident and at ease. Or downhearted people felt happy and hopeful. And if someone felt that his life had been an utter failure and that he himself was only one among millions of wholly unimportant people who could be replaced as easily as a broken pot, he would go and pour out his heart to Momo. And even as he spoke, he would come to realize by some mysterious means that he was absolutely wrong, that there was only one person like himself in the whole world, and that consequently he mattered to the world in his own particular way. Such was Momo's talent to listen. And it goes on to kind of relay a story where two people came to see Momo who were in a fight with each other for a very, very long time. And again, she would just sit there and listen to them, and they would kind of go back to what happened, and slowly, and they would say, "Oh, I got angry with you because of this," and then the other person would say, "Oh, I got angry because of that." And when they actually got to the end of the story, what started it, they realized it was such a small thing that it was actually so easy to let it go and to become friends again. And then after that, it carries on. Momo listened to everyone and everything, to dogs and cats, crickets and toads, even to the rain and the wind in the pine trees. And all of them spoke to her after their own fashion. Many were the evenings when, after her friends had gone home, she would sit by herself in the middle of the old stone amphitheatre, with the sky starry vault overhead, and simply listened to the great silence around her. Whenever she did this, she felt she was sitting at the center of a giant ear, listening to the world of the stars, and she seemed to hear soft but majestic music that touched her heart in the strangest way. On nights like these, she always had the most beautiful dreams. Those who still think that listening isn't an art should see if they can do it half as well. Yes, so meditation, I mean, you will know from Ajahn Brahm's teaching, he often uses the word kindfulness. And that's what really kind of comes out in this story for me. It's the attention, it's the mindfulness, it's the being there, it's the caring for someone at the same time. But also, what is very, very lovely in this story, it is a little child. And little children, they are so innocent. They are very, very curious. And we don't expect them to solve our problems. But we really appreciate their presence. We're very happy to hang out with them. Or they are very happy to just be in nature and listen to, you know, as it was said there, to the rain. Or when we are meditating, we are just listening to whatever is arising in our minds. I don't know, did that kind of story trigger something for you guys that you wish to share? Or because otherwise I would like to just leave it as it is and actually go into the meditation and hopefully use that as a tool this time for the meditation. I quite often use visualization in my meditation because I have quite a visual mind and it really helps me. So this time, if we use Momo, and if we use our minds, so we are not watching with our eyes, really, like it was described here, that she was looking at the people with her big brown eyes. But in meditation, we are listening, and we are there. And sometimes we talk about watching the body or watching the breath, and watching is always kind of very often connected with going out into the world or you know, trying hard. So maybe we can replace that in meditation with listening or with feeling. Even if you just feel your body or if you feel your breath instead of watching it, you might notice that there is, it's quite a different approach. Anyway, so let's get comfortable, and you leave the mic on for meditation as well. Is that right? The mic stays on.
Yeah,
Okay. So I'll just not talk too loudly so it doesn't scare you when you're getting into it. Right, so please make yourselves comfortable on the chairs or on the floor, wherever you're used to sit, and wherever it's comfortable, so you can stay there for a while. And then let's gently close our eyes. So as I said, so we're not watching, so we're not looking outside. Meditation is actually turning inwards, not going out into the world, but seeing what's happening inside. What might be helpful in the beginning is to maybe take 3 deep breaths in through the nose and out through the mouth. And you might already feel that relaxes your body. Because if we breathe in that way, we tell our system and our body that there is no danger around, that now there is time to rest and recuperate. So it's a good thing to do in the beginning to get into the mood. And I almost see it like we are moving inwards through the different layers that are there. And the most outer layer is the body. Because it's quite coarse, it's quite obvious. So let's just listen to what's going on in our bodies. Imagine your little Momo sitting in her amphitheater and your good old body comes along. But now instead of trying to change it or interfere with it, we just listen. We simply feel with curiosity and interest what's going on. We look upon our body with kindness. Ajahn Brahm has this beautiful phrase of simply asking your body, body, is there anything at this stage of the meditation that I can do for you? So you feel more relaxed, you feel more at ease, you feel more happy. Might be moving, might be wiggling, might be scratching, might be coughing. Whatever it is, now is the time to do so. Might be swallowing. Let's just go through a few body parts that often hold a bit of tension. Gently put your attention on the area of your eyes. And see what's going on there, or better, feel what's going on there. And relax all the muscles. Another spot is the jaw. Let your jaw be loose. And relaxed. Then let's move to the neck. And also to the shoulders. Is there anything you can do, or maybe rather not do? Can you let go in that area and let it relax? And then let's move down the spine, vertebra by vertebra, all the way down to the hips. Relaxing it. Just by being there and being friendly towards it. settling down the lower back. All the way down to the hips. And just feel how gravity automatically just keeps you on the chair. You can just relax and go, relax and let go. Now we'll move to a few areas where you might think it's a bit more difficult to reach, where you can't kind of consciously relax your muscles. But just again imagine your Momo sitting there, smiling. Let's see what's happening in our throat. Then in the area around our heart. The middle of the chest. If there is any tension, just let it melt away. By giving it kind attention. And then lastly, let's go down to our belly. Let it soften and become smooth. And relaxed all by itself. Not by doing anything, but by stopping to interfere with things. I hope your body is fairly relaxed by now. If there is any other area that we haven't covered that is uncomfortable, please just put your mindfulness and your kindness there. We do go through our bodies like that and relax them. They tend to fade into the background. And what arises in turn is relaxation and a subtle but very pleasant feeling. Of acceptance of being seen, of being present. That's what meditation is all about. That's what we're cultivating. And now let's proceed in the same way. If there is anything happening in our minds, if there is worries about the past, regrets, if we're thinking or planning about the future, if we're asking ourselves, am I doing it right? What do I have to do next? just enjoy being in the presence of Momo. Just chilling out. And relaxing. We're neither denying or pushing our feelings away, nor are we problem solving, getting involved, or getting carried away. We just sit there, smile, and listen. If we get pulled away by anything happening in the body, we can just proceed as we did in the beginning of the meditation. When there are thoughts, feelings arising, let us acknowledge them. Let us be kind to them. But we are a little child. It's not our job to manage anything, to do anything, to solve anything. We just listen with kindness. We just feel. And we let them come and we let them go. the body and the mind quieten down, calm down. Then we might feel that pleasure again, the pleasure of letting go. Of just being open and receptive. Or we might also become aware of the breathing. Of the air coming in to our body and going out of the body again. Let's just listen to that without doing anything. Let it come and let it go. Like when you were a child at summer camp and there was a big bonfire and you were just so happy to sit there and just watch, listen and feel the fire without being bored. Let us sit there, like Momo, next to our breath, and just be with it. When sensations or thoughts arise, please be kind with them. don't get involved, but just smile at them from a distance and let them pass by. Like the eyes of Momo would settle on the person that is with her and just remain there effortlessly. Let's do that if we can with our breathing. Not thinking about it, but just feeling the breath coming in and going out. Momo's job is not to problem solve. Momo's job is not to do it right. Momo's job is just being herself, being fully present and caring about what's going on. Everyone can let go. But what's difficult is to maintain letting go and becoming more and more relaxed. But if we savor the good, the positive feelings that arise, I'll make them last for longer. And when they disappear, no problem. We can always start again. We're now getting close to the end of the meditation. This is the time when we look back and when we ask ourselves how we feel now compared to when we started. But we don't just ask ourselves how we feel, we also reflect on what we did or what we didn't do to learn how to relax, to learn how to let go, and to learn how to meditate. Please remember this calm, this happiness, this stillness. It's always there. All we have to do is turn inwards and pay attention to it, listen to it, and let it develop and grow. Please feel free to slowly stretch and wiggle and open your eyes and come back to your senses and back to the world outside. Okay, great. How was that? Oh, we have a question, do we?
A question box.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, I'll just...
Good idea. Yes, thank you. Okay, it's nice. The light is coming on slowly. Do we have any questions, any comments from the floor?
You've got a really nice way to set up the attitude of coming into the meditation, very gentle and open and receptive and listening.
Wonderful, thank you. Too much talking or okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. People like it different ways. Okay, well, let's have a look what it says here. Okay, what is the Buddhist teaching in regards to allowing yourself to be vulnerable to others and letting them see your weaknesses? Right. I don't think there is any thing in the suttas that I can think about. But I'll try to answer it just from the practice. And also from reading a few books about these things. Vulnerability is one of those words that has been used quite a lot in the last maybe decade. I do think of Dr. Brené Brown, for the people who know her. She has talked about vulnerability a lot, and she talks about it in a very nice way. Though she says it's actually not weakness. Vulnerability is actually a very, very brave act. If we are allowing ourselves to be vulnerable, if we trust enough either ourselves or if we trust enough another person to show ourselves as we are, I don't really think that is a weakness. And I think it's actually indispensable if we want to grow. Because if you don't see the things that are difficult for you, or if you don't kind of pay attention to the things that hurt or that are vulnerable in you, then they can't actually develop and grow. Yes, letting others see, yes. I mean, you will also know from Ajahn Brahm, the way he teaches and the way he also tells you, I guess, how he's running the monastery, where he says it's very natural that we make mistakes, and that is, so to speak, we could see it as a weakness, but it's actually just what happens in the human condition. Everyone makes mistakes, but if we hide them, if we are not willing to share them with someone, show our difficulties we might have in an area to someone we trust, then it's very unlikely that we will grow in that area. And also what happens is, when we are afraid to make mistakes, when we are afraid to be ourselves, when we're afraid to show ourselves to other people, then we get all tense. We tend to get sick, and we also tend to make more mistakes because we're just so stressed about what we're doing. So that's one of the things that comes up for me with public speaking very often, where there is always a bit of fear that when I come to a place. But when I feel that I can be open with the audience, I can trust the audience, I can just be myself, then a lot of that tension just falls away. And because the tension falls away, I tend to give myself as I am. I don't pretend. And even if, I am afraid, or I have tension in myself, very often we think that we can't have fear and tension and at the same time be gentle with it or work with it. We just kind of think either we are kind or we are afraid. But it's actually a spectrum. And when we allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to look inside, to be tender with whatever there is, then this uncomfortable feeling and this fear tends to go away and shift towards the other positive feelings. Okay, that's what I have to offer for this one. Anything else? Yes, please.
So that was my question, but I think what most people are afraid of,
yes,
when they talk about being vulnerable, it's showing your vulnerability to another person or other,
yes,
people, and then they could take advantage of that.
Yes.
What people are afraid of. But if you, as you were saying, if you develop that thing within you yourself, you get the strength,
yes,
then you can sort of go into that.
Yes. I mean, we have to be careful with what we are sharing. If we are not at the point where we can get input from someone else, or where we feel we could be threatened, then it's usually better to just kind of deal with it within ourselves, or to open up in an atmosphere or with another person where we know that it's not going to happen. I just kind of have this picture in my mind from the past that if we are really truthful, then we usually touch that feeling or that whatever it is in ourselves in the other person, and that usually wouldn't make them turn around and hurt us, because they can understand within themselves what we are talking about. And then they tend not to kind of, turn around and take advantage. I mean, if something like that happens, of course, then we have to be brave enough to, again, state what our feelings are and say, look, this is too much for me, and establish healthy boundaries. But I do feel if there is pride in it, or if there is untruth in it, then it's like a balloon. And if someone comes with a little pin, it pricks and it's a big bang and we're hurt and God knows what. But But if the balloon is not blown up, if the balloon is just as it is, you can poke at it as much as you want. It just doesn't hurt the same way. Yeah. But it is definitely an area that is not easy, and that we have to experiment with and see what works for us and what doesn't. Yep. Anything else about that, or another question? No. I have another part from the book that I wanted to share at this stage. It's a bit more practical. So before we were talking about meditation and how we can use the listening of Momo for meditation. This is a bit more about what we do in day-to-day life and how the meditation informs our day-to-day life. And Momo, she has a friend, and her friend is called Beppo. And Beppo is a street sweeper. And that's from one of those chapters, chapter 4. And there it says the following. Beppo was widely believed to be not quite right in his head. This was because, when asked the question, he would give an amiable smile and say nothing. If, after pondering the question, he felt it needed no answer, he still said nothing. If it did, he would ponder what answer to give. He could take as long as a couple of hours to reply, or even a whole day. By this time, the person who had asked the question would have forgotten what it was, so Beppo's answers seemed peculiar at the extreme. Only Momo was capable of waiting patiently enough to grasp his meaning. She knew that Beppo took as long as he did because he was determined never to say anything untrue. In his opinion, all the world's misfortunes stemmed from the countless untruths, both deliberate and unintentional, which people told because of haste and carelessness. Every morning, long before daybreak, Beppo rode his squeaky old bicycle to a big depot in town. There, he and his fellow road sweepers waited in the yard to be issued brooms and pushcarts and told which streets to sweep. Beppo enjoyed these hours before dawn, when the city was still asleep, and he did his work willingly and well. It was a useful job, and he knew it. He swept his allotted street slowly but steadily, drawing a deep breath before every step and every stroke of the broom. Step, breathe, sweep. Step, breathe, sweep. Every so often, he would pause a while, staring thoughtfully into the distance, and then he would begin again. Step, breathe, sweep. While progressing in this way, with a dirty street ahead of him and a clean one behind, he often had grand ideas. They were ideas that couldn't easily be put into words, though. Ideas as hard to define as a half-remembered scent or a color seen in a dream. When sitting with Momo after work, he would tell her his grand ideas, and her special way of listening would loosen his tongue and bring the right words to his lips. "You see, Momo," he told her one day, "it's like this. Sometimes when you've got a very long street ahead of you, you think how terribly long it is and feel sure you'll never get it swept." He gazed silently into space before continuing. "And then you start to hurry," he went on. "You work faster and faster, and every time you look up there seems to be just as much left to sweep as before. And you try even harder, and you panic. And in the end, you're out of breath, and you have to stop. And still the street stretches away in front of you. That's not the way to do it." He pondered a while. Then he said, "You must never think of the whole street at once. Understand? You must only concentrate on the next step, the next breath, the next stroke of the broom, and the next, nothing else. Again he paused for thought before adding, "That way you enjoy your work, which is important, because then you make a good job of it, and that's how it ought to be." There was another long silence. At last he went on, "And all at once, before you know it, you find yourself, you find you have swept the whole street clean, bit by bit. What's more, you aren't out of breath." He nodded to himself. "That's important too," he concluded. Yeah. Does it make sense? It reminds me a bit of today as well, because I've just come back from Melbourne, and I'm staying in one temporary hut. So got up at 5 o'clock and started cleaning that hut and washing everything in that hut, and then moving to the other temporary hut that another monk would live in, but he lives in another kuti now, so cleaning that one, washing everything. So I was just running up and down the monastery, washing things and folding things. And even before I came here, I still had washing on my bed. So I had to just leave it. As Ajahn says in his story, what's done is finished. Go down, have a cup of tea, sit in the car and relax for half an hour. That was very, very kind of Matt, that's right, for driving me and being silent for half an hour so I could catch my breath. But I think I did what I did throughout the day in a way like Beppo did it. So I would stop while I was doing these things and just take a breath, take a pause, and just do whatever I was doing. So there were a few washing machines going on, and there was one woolen blanket, so I would wash that in between. And if you do these things with mindfulness, if you do these things with just being present, being in the moment, they just kind of flow. And then at the end of the day, I'm not entirely finished with the road, but it looked like a ridiculously long road this morning, and I'm almost done. So it can be done, and I think that's something we really have to learn in life. I mean, this is an exceptional day for a monk. We usually have more time to just, you know, go back to our huts and sit in silence. But there is sometimes days like that, or when I do travel to Europe, there is also about 20 hours where you're just stuck in the plane, and it's going to be happening soon again. So you better find something useful to do. And people kind of ask me very often, you know, because we are not like watching the TV while we're on the plane and all these kind of things, and they just ask, well what do you do? What do you do all those hours? Are you kind of bored, or are you just trying to, I don't know, block out all the sounds and take a pill to sleep for as long as possible? I can sleep quite well on the plane, but of course not 20 hours. So I do meditate as well. But one other practice I've kind of developed for myself is, very often when we kind of rush through our day-to-day life, we don't have time to reflect on things, and we don't really take the time to especially reflect on the things that go well, or to reflect on the things that have meaning for us and that inspire us to carry on in the way that we're doing, or that inspire us to, you know, well, putting in a bit more effort is maybe the wrong word, but just, they inspire us to carry on doing what we're doing. So usually when I sit in the plane, I remember the time I've spent in the place that I've been. So, for example, in Melbourne for the last 2.5 or 3 months, and I just kind of let that pass through my mind and remember all the good things that have happened, all the things that people have done for myself, or the good things I could do for the people. And I never get bored that way. And it's a very nice kind of feeling that arises. And I like plane rides because it's kind of an in-between moment. You have left the place and it's gone. You can't do anything. I mean, these days you can go Wi-Fi on the plane even, or whatever. But on some, I think Singapore Airlines does it, you can even, you know, keep in touch with your friends, but, oh, please, just let go of where you were. And you are not in the new place yet. So it's no point starting to plan or think about it, what you're going to do. You're just in this brilliant in-between present moment where you can just be with your body, you can be with your thoughts, or you can have a practice. You can have something that inspires you. I mean, sometimes I listen to a talk from Ajahn Brahm when I'm on the plane, or I do read a book. But very often, I'm just very happy to be there. And it's just a question what you do with your mind and where you focus your mind. So sometimes I do have a bit of anxiety when I fly, because it's just kind of like you're kind of in this confined space and you don't really want to be there, and people don't want to be there either. And if that is happening, you can either kind of focus on that, put all your attention on that, and what very often happens if you don't do it in the right way, it can become worse. It can become more tense and more fear, and you can go into panic if you have experienced anything like that before. And one time when I was on that plane, when I was walking to the toilet, I was just looking at the people, and just looking at the people with metta in my mind, with loving kindness in my mind, wishing them well, or seeing the kids that are usually fairly happy to just watch, look out of the window, or just whatever. And that just switched completely the whole atmosphere, switched completely the feelings that were going on in myself. So sometimes when there is things that to pull us in, it can be useful to find another object where we can settle our minds on, and that give us relaxation, give us joy and happiness. Sometimes some of those feelings might be too strong, and we might not be able to handle them at that stage. So it can be very, very useful to have the kindness, the metta, or to practice compassion towards yourself or towards the other beings on the plane, or even towards whoever you want to think of. And when you think of these things, your mind brings you there, and your mind brings up those feelings in your mind, and they also translate into the body, and it all changes. So imagination is a very, very strong and useful tool. Unfortunately, we often use imagination in the wrong way. And imagination gone wrong is basically worry. When we are worrying about who is going to be on the other end, I'm a monk, I don't have any money, am I going to be picked up, or whatever it might be. And it's not really useful, and we can't really change it anyway when we are stuck in a plane somewhere. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what usually happens, at a monastery you start off as a postulant. If for the people who have been at Bodhnyana Monastery, we'll see that's the people who are wearing white for the first year. They shave their hair, they wear white. And then you become a novice for 1 year. And then you are a junior bhikkhu for 5 years. And that's the time where you train, where we have different classes, and where you have usually lots of time to practice for yourself. And then the next 5 years, that's when you become a middle monk. And the middle monks, they are starting to serve a little bit more. They come out into the community, like to the Armadale group, to get a bit of practice, to see how that is, to get a few questions, because when you're meditating by yourself, then you have your own questions, but you sometimes don't think outside of the box. So that's kind of usually the time where you do these kind of things. And I happened to go to Melbourne in 2015 with my friend, because the new monastery was coming up, just to have a look, and I really liked the place, and it also kind of came together with me becoming a middle monk. So did I ask? I think it was actually Venerable Chunda who was going there already, who asked me if I wanted to come along, and I did ask Ajahn Brahm if that's okay. We usually get permission from our teacher, and now I've been going for the last 3 years, so I usually spend 3 months there, and I really like the community over in Melbourne. It's a bit smaller. I mean, it's a little bit like the Armidale Meditation Group, when you have to go to when you have the privilege to go and learn in Dhammaloka, where everything is live streamed and there's like, I don't know, 300 or 400 people sitting there. It can be a bit challenging for some people, and Melbourne is just kind of the right mix. We get the opportunity usually after the meal to talk to people. We take turns, and we do go into town to the Buddhist Society of Victoria to teach. But it's a bit smaller, and I just feel that I go there to kind of support the community and to be part of the community and to share. And I really enjoy having a dialogue usually. When I go and give a talk, I usually prepare something little to kind of get going, or to so that I feel I can share something meaningful. But when people do ask questions, then I can actually, you know, hopefully offer something, so I'm not just talking about something which might not be relevant to people at that stage. Sure. Technically we still have time, but I don't have anything to say right at the moment. But if there is anything to ask, I'd be happy to have a...
Where will you spend Rains?
The Rains retreat, usually I would spend at Bodhinyana. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because...
But you mentioned going to Europe again soon.
Yes, but that will be for roughly a month.
Mm-hmm.
My mother is in a nursing home, mm-hmm. and I usually try and go and visit her. And also to see my friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Rains retreat is a period where we don't travel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a period where we intensify our meditation, and where Ajahn Brahm is giving teachings, and he's also giving interviews. So I really, really like to be at Bodhinyana for the Rains retreat. So I haven't gone away for the Rains retreat yet, but I guess there will be a time when that will happen again.
Mm-hmm.
But the Rains retreat is really kind of the period of time where you can recharge your batteries. You have a 3 month in between moment where, you know, you've kind of left from where you were, and you're just in the monastery, you're just sitting in your hut. Of course, if there's funerals or if there is someone in hospital that would like to see a monk, then we go. But all the other activities we try to lessen as much as we can, so we don't have work meetings and things like that. So you can really build up the strength again, build up the calm as well, and also sharpen your wisdom. And then with those batteries, hopefully they'll last for another 9 months. But the wonderful thing at Bodhinyana is also that every 3 months we get 2 weeks of personal retreat. So I haven't had mine yet for the last 3 months. So we'll see how it goes in terms of the other work. But it is really important to have that balance.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I have a question about near-death experience.
Oh, yes.
Do you believe in some of these people who have had near-death experiences? Do you think it's real, or is it just a chemical reaction in the mind,
yes.
imagination?
Yes, I do believe that it is real. There is a couple of experiments that were done, also with people who had cardiac arrests. And what very often happens is that the people come back and they know things that they just can't know. And one of the classical examples is that one patient died on the operating table, and what usually happens, you float outside of your body towards the ceiling. That's what many, many people kind of report. And there was... The windows in the operating theater were very, very high, like the windows here. So just that there would be a little bit of light coming in, but you wouldn't have spectators outside or whatever. And there was a tennis shoe on the ledge up on those windows. And the person reported that the tennis shoe was there. And there was no way that the person could have seen it because the windows were so high up. And there is other incidences where they say they've heard conversations, what the doctors were saying, or even what was going on in a room next doors, and that is very, very convincing evidence for myself that is a real thing, and that it can't just be created in the brain. And near-death experiences and meditation, or dying in meditation, are actually very, very similar. We are letting go of the body, we're letting go of the senses, and we are just turning inwards, we're turning towards the mind. And that's what happens at the moment of death, where the mind starts to let go of the body. And what people very, very often report as well with near-death experiences that you might have all heard is those tunnels. They kind of leave their bodies, they go into a tunnel, and they see a bright light at the end of the tunnel. And the bright light is basically what happens in meditation as well. It's the nimitta. It's the mind. That's the way the mind shows itself in deep meditation. So I definitely believe in these things. Yeah. And if you think of it, you know, you're letting go of all these things, and then again they say there is this kind of movie theater thing that happens, where people remember what happened in their life. And that would also kind of make sense with the process of going from one life into the next life. So a lot of people get very caught up with the last moment when you're dying. So they say you have to really, really make sure that that last moment is pure and that people are happy and that that happiness will take them into their next existence. But from the near-death experiences, we know that that is not just one moment. That is something that actually takes a long period of time. And what usually happens is that the memories from your life come up, the memories that were really powerful, and they will propel you into your next existence. They will kind of, the feeling tone of those, of your mind at that stage, that's where you will be going in the future. But that might be a bit supernatural. I don't know, is this okay for the Armadale group? Anyway, I mean, some people might not believe in rebirth, but yes, near-death experiences. If you meet someone who had one, please ask. But usually they are very, very convincing, and also people really, they change their lives a lot when they have experiences like that. So there must be something very, very powerful happening.
But this business of seeing your life,
yes,
happens also in abseiling. If you abseil,
yes,
fast enough,
yes,
I don't know how fast it's fast.
Right.
For me, when I did abseiling,
yes,
I just went.
Right.
I was begging people to go, so I just went. And as you go down, whether it's faster than my heart beat or whatever, I could remember everything that happened to me.
Right.
All of a sudden, like, yes, it didn't take long.
Yes.
And then you touch the ground, and it's all gone.
Yes.
So something else can actually trigger.
Yes. Yes.
Remembering your life.
That's correct. You know? Yeah. At the moment where you very often where you let go of your body.
Yeah.
Let go of your senses at that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. Then it tends to arise. I mean, there's this one story with Ajahn Brahm as well, where he was quite young and he went hiking, and it was just so foggy, and he went over a cliff somewhere, even though the cliff was just very kind of small as well. But he went down and fell on his backpack, and nothing happened. But he said he had the same experience.
Yes. Yeah.
Of this just kind of flash.
Yeah, I also had it in an accident. Like,
right.
I was driving to go to work in Scotland, and the fog and also the black ice on the ground, and the front of my car, what you call it, the bonnet, flung open. I couldn't see.
Right.
I just couldn't see.
Yeah.
And they tell you always don't brake in the black snow. But what else can you do when many cars behind you and many cars ahead of you you'll have to tell somebody something is wrong.
Yes.
So I hit the brake, car jumped on the median strip, went to the other traffic, but lucky enough nobody was coming that way, moved again, and all what I said, you know, help me, Santa Maria, because I'm looking at the cross in my in my car, and the car stopped on the median strip with the engine running, as if nothing happened. And people pooping the horn and that for me, and by then, you know, I got out of the car and took my boots off, one of them, and I beat up the bonnet to go down and hang on to it, and I got in and I drove off. In this moment of spinning, I saw my life again.
As well. Yes.
You know, as well.
Yes.
And when I got to work and I passing by the room of my colleagues, and they said, "Oh, good morning, how are you? You look green this morning." And I just felt like I had no knees. Huh. I just fell on my knees on the ground and I started to cry.
Huh.
"Oh, come on, you know, you're okay." And
well, but stress,
you know, but you see your life, you see, passes by.
Yes, the mind is a wondrous thing. There's many things that happen in the mind. When you do meditate, you might have some of those experiences.
You were saying about the tunnel and the light at the end. You were saying about the mind, that's where the light is.
Yes.
Can you bit more tell me? That's a new analogy.
We tend not to talk about these things too much because sometimes people start craving for these things, and that's not really helpful. But usually what happens when we let go of our body, for most people a light does arise, but it's not a light that you're seeing with your eyes. And these things that do happen in meditation are often just a sign that you are starting to let go, and that the senses are fading away, that you're turning inwards.
Yeah.
And the best thing you can say about it, it's like a reflection. It's not the mind itself, but it's the way that the mind is perceived at that time in meditation. But it's something that happens and arises naturally.
Thank you. Very good.